Sessions. Physical preparation.
This episode of the Physical Preparation Podcast is sponsored by the Physical Preparation Summit. If you're serious about taking your understanding of athletic development to the next level, this event is for you. Over the course of 2 days, we're going to dive deep into topics like speed development, program design, and nutrition. And we're bringing in world-class experts like Bill Hartman, Mike Roussel, Lauren Landau, Doug Kachijian, and Derek Hansen. The bottom line is the speakers are top-notch and it's going to be a fantastic event. And furthermore, we've got a ton of networking and social events planned as well to make sure you not only learn a ton in the seminar, but have a bit of fun outside of it as well. For more information, please check us out online at physicalpreparationsummit.com. Again, that's physicalpreparationsummit.com. I hope to see you there. Hello and welcome to the Physical Preparation Podcast. I'm your host, Mike Robertson, and I'm joined on the line today by Todd Baumgartner. Todd is a guy who I'd heard about for years, but didn't actually meet until this past January at a seminar here at IFAST. Needless to say, he's a guy I have a ton of respect for and who is doing things the right way in our industry. Now let me tell you something up front. This is a really good interview. We cover topics like the importance of environment, the three types of people you'll encounter in the gym, and Todd's thoughts on internal versus external cueing. There are some really great nuggets in here, and I hope you enjoy the show. Let's do this. Todd, man, thanks so much for coming on the show here today. Could you start by just telling us a little bit about yourself?
Yeah, absolutely, man. So first, thank you, because this is a huge honor, man. I can remember being like 20 years old and being at the library at school and bringing up your TMAG articles and everything. So this is huge for me. So it's kind of surreal. So I really appreciate the opportunity first and foremost, man. So thank you. But beyond that, man, I'm just a dude from Pennsylvania. I live in Virginia now. Been lifting weights for a long time, and I managed to figure out how to turn that into a career and focused on coaching. And it's been a pretty cool ride. So that's me in a nutshell. Lifting weights, coaching, fly fishing. That's me. So
it's a beautiful thing, right?
It is, dude. It's awesome. It's crazy to. I never, you know, growing up or anything, never thought it was even remotely could be a reality. So to actually make it happen is crazy. So
very cool. Very cool. And what originally led you into this world of physical preparation?
Yeah. So, my brother, when I was about 12 years old, started introducing me to weightlifting because it was something he did. He's significantly older than I am. He's like 11 years older than I am. And, he put a barbell in my hand. He would drag me along to the gym with him and his buddies, and I started lifting with them. You know, I wanted to be – I always thought I wanted to be one of the big guys on the football team. It turned out I was always one of the fast guys, but I always wanted to be one of the big guys. So I'd always lift with them, and I started powerlifting at 14 and did that the whole way through the high school. I made that like my spring sport. But it turned out that, you know, the iron was just like the most consistent thing in my life. And I just turned it into an intellectual pursuit. And then I turned it into a career. And it started, I was at Lycoming College. That's where I went to school. I played ball there. And, you know, while I was there, I'd find myself, man, I'd be in the library and I'd go there to do my work or whatever. I was a psych major and I'd find myself on T-Nation, or I'd get access to some journal and I'd print out articles, right? And I'd sit there and read those all night. And it got to the point where, I mean, I still did all right in school. I didn't mess up or anything, but I ended up just being like, why am I fighting this anymore? So I started to change course a little bit. I started taking more science classes, and I decided I was going to go to grad school, you know, for exercise science. And about that time, I was working as a student supervisor at the rec. And I had a really cool boss, and her name was Laura Johnson. She's unbelievable. And she's since moved on, and she's at a school down in Florida now. But, and I worked with this really cool girl who was a senior on the lacrosse team. And she was like, she saw me lifting all the time, and she kind of knew that I turned it into a study thing for me. And I was planning on going to grad school. And she was like, you know, let me talk to my coach. Maybe you could be our strength and conditioning coach. So me being like 20, 21 years old, I got this gig for $7.25 an hour training the women's lacrosse team at Lycoming College, and I trained them all fall, and it was terrifying. First of all, I was very aware of my shortcomings yes. as a coach and my knowledge, and I was like, I don't know everything I need to know to make this go the way that it should, but I just swung anyway. And then to go and try to coach girls that you have class with every week is bizarre, but it's a tough world to navigate. So I did that, and then I ended up getting a gig with the softball team then too. And then from there, it was just, I went right into grad school after that and ended up getting an internship and got a place at a place called Victory Sports Performance in State College, Pennsylvania. And that's actually where I met Chris. And they ended up hiring me off of an internship and then just kind of kept the ball rolling from there, man. So that was the transition.
That's awesome. It reminds me of my second year in kind of the world of strength and conditioning, and I was helping out with various teams at Ball State, but I was working with the women's soccer team. And so almost every Wednesday, the girl who was like the GA for the team would leave because she wanted to go hang out with her boyfriend. So it would be me and 25 girls trying to run through these workouts. I mean, it was total and utter chaos.
It's brutal.
It is.
It's brutal. It's how do you maintain some semblance of order? And it was a bizarre thing because they'd come to my football games, and this you have so many different social dynamics to navigate. It's really strange.
Yes, but. Totally understand. Okay, so last but not least, tell us a little bit about where you're at now, BSP Nova, all that good stuff.
Yeah, man. So in April, I moved down here to Virginia. To help Chris run BSP Nova. And Chris and I started the original Beyond Strength Performance business back in 2010 when we were like 24 years old. We had no idea what we were doing. And, but I've been a couple places since then. I moved up to Connecticut and worked at Ramphone Training Systems for a little while. I left there last summer because I just wanted to go and do some different things. I didn't really want to be in Connecticut anymore. Just want to move on. And, so Chris, after some time, I debated. I was like, I really like Chicago. I just like this city, so I almost moved there. But, Chris and I were in some talks, and, his family had been prodding both of us for years for me to come down here. And, we just work really well together. We're I think the biggest thing is beyond all the business stuff, we have a friendship and a love for each other that supersedes everything. So we really take care of each other. We really vibe off of each other, and we work well together. So I came down here and I do most of the staff development stuff for our guys. And then I also coach and help Chris with the business development stuff as well. And it's been a really cool, transition. We have a really cool environment. So I'm really happy to be here so far. And then with Strength Faction, man, that was crazy. So last August was my last month at Ramphone Training Systems. And, a few years before, Chris and I had this idea to do this group coaching program online. And we had no idea how we were going to make it happen. We just had this idea and we thought it would be really cool to do and it could help a lot of people. But we didn't have any means to bring it to fruition. I think most of it was we just didn't know enough. I mean, we didn't have enough context to really understand what we would really need to do or what people would really need from us. And we probably honestly at the point weren't the guys to give it to them anyway. But I knew I wanted to build something a little bit bigger, something that had a bigger reach in the industry. And Chris and I had talked about that. So it's funny. I think it was August 31st of last year. I'm driving home, from Connecticut to Pennsylvania. My car's all packed up. I'm moving home, for a few months. And I called Chris and I was like, "Hey man, you remember that online coaching program we wanted to run?" And he's like, "Yeah, man." I was like, "Yeah, we're gonna do it." He's like, "Awesome." And I was like, "Yeah, it starts in 2 weeks. I'm gonna put up a post about getting volunteers right now." So we just kind of went after it. We had a general outline of what we knew we wanted to look like and who we wanted to work with, and we settled on coaches. And first we took volunteers. We thought maybe we'd get 5 to 10 people. We ended up with 20 guys. Then they were mixed match. Some were coaches, some were not. And we just built out this cohort program that's 16 weeks. And we train the guys. What we really wanted to create was an experiential learning program, right? Because what we've found through our experience is, we go to seminars, we do all these other things, and that's great. But the experience of having the information given to you while you're also using it, we think takes people a lot farther. So that's really what we wanted to create. So we've worked hard to do that, and we do it in cohort fashion, and people have a really cool dashboard with lessons and programming, and we do a really cool Q&A that we were thankful enough to have you on, and you know, we do a lot of cool stuff with it, so I'm really excited about it.
Yeah, no, I'm very impressed with what you guys have rolled out, and I'm excited to see what you got going on going forward. But today, I really want to focus on the coaching and the queuing and the psychology piece, because I'm fascinated by that. It's funny, you mentioned you were a psych major and you got into training. I was an XI major, but I was a counseling psych minor, because I was always interested in the psychology piece. So with that being said, could you just give us your general philosophy when it comes to coaching and queuing?
Yeah, I think honestly, man, it just comes down to one word. And Bill and I have talked about this in pretty much every conversation we've ever had. And I think that word is context. And I think that is the biggest word that coaches need to understand when coaching. So I think our job as coaches is to create context and to educate and then give people the means to coach themselves. So rather than being so declarative and giving people solid, like stringent, this is how things work, we create the environment, we create the context, we give them the information that helps them make the right decisions, and we ask more questions than I think we give a lot more direct answers. So in a nutshell, that's really my overarching philosophy with how we coach and what we've really instilled at BSP Nova.
Yeah, no, it's really hard to argue the concept of context, because like you said, and I know Nick Winkelmann's talked about this too, I always use his analogy, but his analogy is that, you know, I'm not a huge fan of the wall drill for a sprinting acceleration, but the wall drill gives these athletes context so that when I take them out and I take them through another drill or I teach them to accelerate, now they have some sense of context on what I'm trying to get out of, you know, the specific drill or movement pattern.
Exactly. I mean, that's 100% it. And it's context with, you know, physically what position we put them in, how we educate, all of those things I think are super important. And, you know, a simple example, I think, is the plank and just giving people names for good positions and bad positions. So we use long or tall. That's our good position. Macho man is our bad position, where people slip too far into extension. And if people go too far into flexion, we say sad dog. And we teach that right away, and it gives us context for pretty much everything we coach throughout the gym. And I think it's just simple tasks like that where then we don't have to say much. People can correct themselves, and it feels like they have more autonomy and more ownership over what they're doing. Because at the end of the day, and I'm sure that you'll be 100% in agreement with this, is our job is to make our job obsolete and get people to the point where they don't really need us anymore.
Yes. Oh, my God. Yes. And by the way, have you ever met Jay Chung?
I met him when we came out for the Jameson seminar.
Oh my gosh, you guys would be best friends. He is the master of cues like that too, like poison dart, and I can't even think of all of them. But you know, he's the master of little things like that to create a specific light bulb moment for the clients. So
That's awesome.
So another thing that we discussed in preparation for the show is using the right interaction with the right people. And I can't stress this highly enough. This is something that young coaches absolutely need to hear. There's not a blanket approach. It's not one size fits all. But what I want is for you to expand on that idea a little bit, that you can't coach and treat everyone the same.
100%. That's 100% of everything. I mean, I think that's context and personality and really understanding people, and blanket approaches are going to frustrate you and frustrate your clients. And I think I may oversimplify this, but I break people down into three buckets. And obviously, you know, you don't want to put people in buckets, but sometimes for buckets as in like a judgmental state, but like to be able to make decisions and help give people information the way they need to hear it, I think it's really simple. And what we use are three categories: what people, why people, and how people. So what people are your folks that would just run through a brick wall. All you got to tell them what to do, they'll do it. No questions asked. That's all they need from you. They don't need a ton of moral support. They don't need a ton of interaction. They just want to know what they have to do, and they're going to go do it, and they're going to kick ass the whole time. So we have those people. So at that end, those are typically the people that you have to curtail a little bit, right? Like, hey, these are your classic overworkers. So if there's anything to pay attention to with those people, it's that aspect of things. Yep. Why people just want to know why they're doing what they're doing. As soon as you can give them that explanation, they'll attach to whatever you want them to do and they'll go work their butt off for it. But they just have to know why. They have to be able to conceptualize and intellectualize things for them to be able to take action. So if you treat them like a what person, you're going to lose them. They just don't. They need that explanation. They need something to connect to. I use a story when I present on this. I had a kid up in Connecticut, and he'd worked with a bunch of other trainers before, a bunch of other physical therapists. He's a super tall kid. He was like 6'8", and he was like 6'4" when he was like 12 years old. So they got this kid out there like ripping pitches and throwing too much, throwing too often, throwing pitches he shouldn't be throwing. So he has Tommy John. He's like 13. And, you know, a brutal comeback. And everybody just has him doing stuff. Just they don't give him any explanation. They're just like, this is what we're going to do. This is what we're going to do. And if you pay attention to the kid, he's really bright. He wants to understand. He wants to conceptualize. And he never attached and he never got better and he just kept struggling. And, you know, one day I just started giving him explanations, told him why we were doing what we were doing, and he attached to that. And ever since then, the kid just started busting his ass, working hard, and he ended up landing himself a Division I scholarship at a small school in Connecticut. But the key was no one understood how they needed to talk to that kid. They just kept giving him directions without, you know, he felt, I guess, somewhat slighted because no one felt like he was smart enough to get an explanation, and that's all he wanted. And then the third category are how people. And I nickname these people hug people because these are the people that I make some type of appropriate contact with immediately every time I see them. They just want to know how you feel about them, how the people in the room feel about them, and how they're supposed to interact while they're there. And they ask a ton of questions about how they're supposed to do stuff. So we call them how people. And you just have to interact with them, make them feel welcome, make them feel accepted. They'll work their butts off. They'll do everything you ask of them, and they'll really get a lot of good results. But if you treat them like a why person, just tell them what they're doing or why they're doing what they're doing, they don't really care. They want to know how you feel about them first. Or if you treat them like a what person and you just say, here, this is what you're doing, they're going to feel somewhat disenfranchised and they're not going to attach and you're going to lose them. So I think one of the big things that coaches need to understand, especially young coaches that really don't have as much life experience with people and understanding how people interact in different contexts, and then being able to pay attention and intuit what people need from you, is to understand that you have to not necessarily use these, but you have to have some kind of system where you can understand people's personalities and how you need to interact with them as a coach. Because, I mean, that's everything for us. Like, we can't do our job if we can't do that, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. And this will actually work as a really nice segue because, you know, you've been doing this for a while, and I'm just really interested in your thoughts because I've never heard somebody describe, you know, the three types of people like that. I think that's really brilliant. But in your opinion, what are some of the most common mistakes that coaches make when they're cueing clients or athletes?
Yeah, I think there's three big ones. Too much information. So you're giving people too much information at once. You're trying to fix too much at once. Or you try to fix right away. And I think that comes back to context. So I'll jump in with that one. So one of the first things that we drone on about with our guys and that I talk about a lot is letting the first rep suck. Unless someone's in a really dangerous environment and they could get hurt, let the first rep suck. It gives them context of what bad feels like. People need to feel what that feels like before they feel what good feels like. But a lot of times, you know, you'll see a younger guy or a less experienced trainer see something that doesn't look great and immediately jump in with a correction. And I think that that's a huge mistake because you're cutting off your ability to really coach more effectively and to let people coach themselves. So if we do our job up front and we create context and we educate, letting the first rep suck is the perfect opportunity to teach someone to coach themselves. And I think that that's a huge mistake is people make corrections too quickly. Yeah. And then I'm sorry, go ahead.
No. Sorry, cut you off. Go ahead.
No. Okay, so it's no big deal. But then from there, it's just – and then they try to fix too much at once. So, you know, one of the big rules that we make is one thing per rep or one thing per set. So I guess let's use a rack pull as an example. And let's say maybe they were rounding at the back and they were also shooting their knees under the bar rather than extending their hips and knees simultaneously. So fix one. Which one do you think is the most priority? Which one's going to keep them safer? Which one's going to accomplish more? Attempt to coach that first. Just work on that and then go back to the next thing. If you do one thing and you hit the right nail, you might fix everything you need to fix and then come back to smaller priorities. And then beyond that is just too much information at once. And I think that that's in the way we communicate, we can say too much, we can try to fix too much. So one of the things that we've come up with is our coaching mantras. So we only give little bits of information because we think about what's all going on in someone's cognitive process when they're actually trying to perform. So they got a social situation. They want to please you as somewhat of an authority figure. They have efferent information going out. They have afferent information coming back. And that's a lot on the brain. That's a lot on the processor. So if we throw a bunch more language in there, it's going to slow them down. It's going to confuse them even more. So we use mantras that have three letters. An example is the hinge. So we use TRD for the hinge. Tall and tight, reach, drive. All three actions that you really need to have done for the hinge are right there. So we create the context of what that means. Say TRD, they can internalize that, repeat it to themselves, keeps them in the moment, and it doesn't give them much information. And it really allows them to stay where they need to be without having to overthink or having too much loaded on top of them.
I love it. Do you, by any chance, do you have interns at BSP Nova?
We don't right now. We don't right now, but we typically do.
Okay. Well, the reason I ask is these are the exact things that we teach our interns. It's like every single time at some point we have these discussions, you know, like you're over queuing, you're giving them too much at once, you know, all of these same things. So this is absolutely fantastic. Now, there's been a lot of talk on internal versus external queuing in our industry. Mm-hmm. I obviously have my own thoughts. I think we've all got our own thoughts and opinions on the topic, but I'm interested to hear yours. What are your thoughts on internal versus external queuing?
Totally. I think they're both valid. I think it's been ill-advised or unwarranted that a lot of people have jumped off of internal queuing completely and went 100% towards external queuing. I think they're both valid, and I think it all comes back to the word context. I think you have to understand what your current environment is. So we break it down into two things. Is this a learning environment or is it a performance environment? So if we're in a learning environment and people are very kinesthetically unaware, they're trying to figure out where parts of their body are so they can integrate stuff into it. Internal cues are great. This is where we can use tactile stuff. We can ask people if like, hey, this is what your hips feel like when they're moving. This is what your glutes feel like. This is what it's like when your spine moves. And using internal cues in a learning environment to give people the context to understand what it feels like when their body moves, I think is a great idea because they have to intellectualize it at that point. They have to use some kind of cognitive process to understand where they are in space or what something feels like. And then from there, when we move into the performance environment, we can use the external cues because that's where we don't want higher center brain function. We want to keep people in lower parts of their brain because it's faster. We just want to give them some kind of cue that allows them to perform. So push away from the floor or something like that where they don't have to internalize or use a lot of thought is going to work a lot better. But I think it's very short-sighted to poo-poo on internal cues entirely. I think there's still a time and a place for those.
I'm glad you said that because those are my exact same thoughts. I didn't know that that's what you were going to say. But yeah, I think there's absolutely a time and a place for, you know, the internal cues and especially like, look, athletes are one animal, right? And like you said, in a performance environment, but especially if you work with average everyday people, a lot of these people, their kinesthetic awareness is so, so poor. They need that internal cueing. You know what I mean? They need to learn more about their body, how their body works, how it moves, when it's moving well, when it's not. So I love hearing you say that.
100%, man. Especially you got Mrs. Jones coming off the street with a training age of zero, or especially someone that's like, you know, coming back from injury and really has to reintegrate the way things work in their body. Like, I think those are perfect examples of times when internal cues are very valuable and effective.
Absolutely. All right, man, here's a tough one. What's the biggest mistake you've made when training a client or athlete?
Yeah, I mean, this one is tough because I've made a lot of mistakes, a ton of them, probably more things than I've done right. But I would probably say being too rigid with programming. I mean, I think we all go through that phase where we're like, this is – the holy grail of everything. And I spent 4 hours writing this, and then you better appreciate this work that I've done for you. And then you come in and it doesn't work. And you're like, you just stick to it anyway, because you're so emotionally attached to what you just did. And I think that's probably where I've messed up the most.
Yes. Or the person comes in totally unprepared to train that day.
Right.
You know what I mean? Well, it says 3x5 at 85%. Damn it, we're doing it, you know?
Exactly. And just, I mean, luckily we've had guys like Joel and all those other guys and like you educate us on readiness and what that means, and to really have the understanding of that. But, you know, there was a time when I didn't have that knowledge, and I just, this is pretty and this all makes sense, and I wrote it all down and this is what we're going to do. So that's probably the most frequently made mistake in my life has probably been that.
Yeah. And I think you're totally right too. It's so many of the things that we now look at as mistakes are phases that we all go through as coaches.
Right.
You know, it's like, you just can't speed up the process. I mean, some people go through the process faster than others, but like everybody is going to make some of these same mistakes along the way. It's kind of like your rite of passage to get to a point where you're training at a higher level.
Totally. Yeah, I think you have to make them. I think you totally do, because it all comes back to context. It's like, you know, Bill was talking with us, I think either when he came out to present or when we did a Q&A with him. And it's like, you have to have that base level of knowledge for one, so you can make higher, you can have higher level thoughts and make higher level decisions. And so you don't get duped. And part of that process is just messing up, man. It's just going out there and swinging hard and trying and learning that it doesn't work. And then you come back 2 or 3 years later and you're like, yeah, that wasn't very smart, but you know, I did the best of what I could with what I had.
Yeah.
But I think you're 100% right. I think, you know, going through that process and those growing pains is what gives us the ability to be better coaches later.
Absolutely. Now, one thing that I haven't heard discussed much before is the idea of environment. Because I'm a big believer that in the environment we create for our clients and our athletes is really critical to their success. So is this a statement you'd agree with? And if so, are there any tips you have on building a better environment in your gym or in your facility?
Yeah, I mean, I couldn't agree more. I think that I think it's everything. I think, you know, if you look at guys like Mark Fisher and what they're doing in New York, I think it really speaks to what environment can do for someone or for a group of people. But I think the biggest thing, because if you look at those guys, Mark Fisher, they're heralded in our industry now, right? Like they're zany, they're wild. They create a great environment that people love to be a part of and learn in, but people try to replicate it. And I think that is a huge mistake, because I think the first rule of environment is just being authentic. Like if you're wild and crazy and zany, be it. Be that and make that in your environment. If you're not, if you're more reserved, or that's the community that you live in, be authentic to that. And I think the truth that it really begins with just kind of knowing who you are and knowing, you know, and really being true to that and being authentic. And then from there, I think it's understand what you want to create. So if you understand who you are and what you want to build, I think it's way easier to create that environment. And then from there, you just have to understand who's in front of you. Training in a college team is going to be way different than training private general pop and the environment that you need to create for people. So I think those three things and having that context are really the big things to creating a good environment.
No, it's absolutely fantastic. All right. So before we get to the big stuff at the end here, I'd love to just get your thoughts on a couple specific exercises, because people want the Monday morning value, right? Regardless of when they listen to this, they want something that they can walk away with and apply. So
Let's
use an example here. Many people and many clients struggle with hinging, right? Whether it's an RDL, a deadlift, what are your ninja tricks there? And yes, I realize your cues are going to have to be on point because we're doing this audio versus video. So what do you have for me?
Yeah. I think we come back to context, and context works in a couple different ways here. I'm as you know, because I've gotten your products and I've seen how you put together your core curriculum and everything. And the 4x4 matrix, I think, is huge when coaching the hinge, and that's something that I really rely on to help fix things quickly. So I'll tell a quick story. So last summer when I was at RTS, we had a kids program for kids like 11 to 13, and there was some hinging built in there. And I think we were doing some kind of kettlebell deadlift or something like that. And I was watching the kids, and you know, they just didn't understand where to put themselves. They didn't understand the difference. They didn't have the context to understand how to dissociate their hips from their spine. So, and I think that that is the overarching problem that people have with hinging, is they don't understand how to dissociate those two parts of their body. Yep. So they just end up moving them together. So I think that's the biggest ninja trick for getting someone to hinge well, is teach them how to dissociate their hips from their spine. But I think that's very position dependent. So we have to use things like the 4x4 matrix. You know, what level of threat do they have in gravity? And also, how are they loaded, to really get people to learn. So what I did with them real quickly, and this is something that's just carried over and we've used time and time again since then, is a cat-cow and a kneeling handcuffed hip hinge. So with a cat-cow, what does that teach us? It teaches us where our spine is. So I would cue them to do the cat-cow and say, do you understand how this is your spine moving? Do you feel your spine moving there and not your hips? From there, we went to the kneeling hip hinge. So what does that do for us? If we put the handcuff where we took a kettlebell and they held it behind their back, and I had them, you know, create a little tension by trying to pull it in half, we got some upper body stiffness. We can lock the spine in place by kneeling. We don't have to worry about what the ankles are doing, or worrying about how far we're into gravity or trying to control the knees too much. We can really just focus on what the hips are doing. And then having the kettlebell held behind our back gave us some context of where to push our hips. So we cued ourselves. We create an environment that they could just learn in without me having to say a whole lot. And then we worked on push back into the kettlebell. Do you feel how that's your hips moving and your spine don't move? Doesn't move throughout that range? And then we took it back to standing. So once they had the context to understand the difference between their spine moving and their hips moving, they could integrate it into their movement. So that's kind of like a real quick transfer from a learning environment into a performance environment, just by using position and having people understand, or especially young people, or young people that are people of the young training age, the difference in how to integrate those into movement.
That's very cool. It's actually an exercise I've seen Bill Hartman use way back in the day. I'm reminded of like when we first started iFast. I know he had a couple people doing that, and I used to think, man, why is he doing that? You just described it better than he did, though. So
that's funny. Good for you, man. I have a hard time believing that.
Make sure you let him know that, too.
I will.
I don't want his head getting too big.
I'm going to call him right after we get off here.
I love it.
You said that.
Awesome. All right. I'm going to put this next one on you. What's the most common lift or exercise that you see butchered, and how do you fix it?
You know what? Let's just stick with the hinge, because we do a fair amount of deadlifting at our place, even with our general pop people. People like to do it. It's pretty effective. But I think what people need to understand, especially coaches, are bodily proportions and where someone's going to fit. So I think you see a lot of people pulling from the floor that shouldn't be pulling from the floor, or people pulling conventional that should be pulling sumo. So I think understanding proportions is huge. So does someone have the right proportions to pull conventionally safely from the floor and do it with strength? So if you have someone with a super long torso and short arms and short femurs, they're probably not going to be in the most advantageous position to pull conventional. And you're going to see that fulcrum jump from their hips right up into their back really quickly, even if they look like they're set in a good position at the bottom. So one thing there, elevate the bar for them. If you really find a use for them to pull in a conventional stance, put them in a rack pull where their leverages don't count for as much or aren't as big of a disadvantage. But from there, or put them in sumo and let them pull sumo, because it's just safer, because their proportions are better set up for it. So I think the biggest thing there is just people not paying attention to that. How are people built? Are they built to deadlift this way? Are they built to squat this way? And paying attention to making sure that we're making decisions based on that.
Oh, awesome. All right, man. Big question time. Are you ready?
Let's do it.
All right. If you could alter the space-time continuum and give young Todd Bumgardner one piece of advice about training and or life, what would it be?
This is probably going to sound bad when I first say it, but I think I can explain it well enough. And that would be to be more selfish. For a long time, I had a really hard time saying no, and I would overextend myself, and I would try to do everything for everyone, and I'd say yes, and I'd put too much on my plate, or I'd put myself in a precarious position because I just wanted to please someone or say yes to something, and it ended up getting me in a lot of trouble in a lot of different ways throughout my entire life, whether that be professional or personal. And I think the biggest thing was for me is when I got to the point where I was like, no, I'm gonna do what I need to do for me first and take care of me and then go from there. So I think saying no and setting boundaries, if I could go back and, I don't know, maybe like 16, 17, 18 year old Todd and have a talk with him, I think that would probably be where I'd start is, you know, hey man, you got to take care of you first and say no and be a little more selfish, because you can't really do all the things that you want to be able to do for other people until you do that.
You know, that's really great advice, because I think a lot of us get into coaching because we're passionate about helping others, and it's very easy to get overrun by that at some point in time. You know what I mean?
Totally, dude. I think it's huge, and I think it's something that young people need to hear, especially because people in our field are super ambitious. Like, you see kids doing multiple internships and working multiple jobs just to do this. And they want to they look up to guys like you. They look up to guys in the field and they really want to, you know, make sure they make a good impression and get themselves where they want to be. And it's just, they put too much on themselves. They burn out and it just doesn't work. And I think it's really important for kids to hear that.
No, that's awesome. Awesome advice, man. All right, let's hit our lightning round. We got four. Actually, I'm going to ask five questions. I'm going to put you on the spot with one, too, okay?
Okay, no problem, man.
All right, number one. What person has had the biggest influence on your coaching career?
Yeah, this is – I mean, I'm sure a lot of people are going to expect a coach or somebody to look up to, but I'm going to go with my mom. She has worked so hard for her entire life, and you know, she did a lot for me. Essentially was a single parent for most of the time that she raised me, and then was a single parent for a long time. You know, I saw her work so hard, and she worked at a job that she despised, but she went there every day. She busted her ass and she did what she had to do to make sure that, you know, I was taken care of. So for me to sit there and have this really cool job that I love and to not appreciate it and not be grateful for all of her sacrifices, you know, for doing something that she didn't even get to do what she wanted to do for her entire life. And I can do whatever I want to do every day of my life. So every time I feel like I'm being a little bit soft, or, you know, maybe I want to sleep in an extra hour, or I don't want to stay up an hour later and get something done, I sit there and I remember like all the stuff that my mom's done for me, and it gives me a really good push. There's just no way, I'd be where I am, first of all, if it wasn't for the sacrifices that she made. And as an adult, looking at that and having the understanding of, you know, if I don't do what I can do to make my life better and to make other people's lives better, it's just such a huge slap in the face to her.
No, that's number one. That's awesome. But number two, can I just tangent for a second?
Go for it, man.
Could you imagine, like, not being as passionate as you are about this industry? Like, I talk to guys like you, or, you know, I talk to a guy, Gary Schofield. I mean, that guy, I mean, he's just got the juice. He sleeps like 3 hours a night. You know, it's like, could you imagine not doing what we do? I can't. No. I literally can't. I don't know what else I would do with my life.
Man, I tried it, man. I had, when I first got out of school and I was going to grad school, like, I had a 9-to-5 and I couldn't do it. I mean, It just doesn't make any sense. Like, you just feel soulless. You feel like something's being sucked out of you. And I can't imagine being someone that goes to work every day and hates my job and just gets through it. I don't understand it. I don't understand how people do it for their entire lives. I really don't.
Yeah. I mean, it's no wonder people are miserable, you know?
Yeah, right. 100%.
I just couldn't imagine doing that. So very thankful for what we have here.
Absolutely.
Number two, I asked Chris this, he gave me like 10. So I'm going to try and continue a little bit. What book or books are you reading right now and why?
Yeah, I don't even try to keep up with Chris anymore,
man.
He's
a monster. He's a monster.
I don't know how he does it. I don't even try to do it anymore. I got two on deck right now. So I'm reading Biocentrism and I'm reading Legacy. So I think it's really important for us to, in our industry, to read outside our content area, because I think a lot of people get really caught up with whatever's going on, and then you become an automaton or an ideologue, and you don't really have the context to think for yourself. So I always keep a book in the hopper that kind of stretches my brain and just makes me think a little bit differently, and really just builds the raw materials up there rather than just ingesting more fitness material, because you get to a certain point, and, you know, and I know that I have so much more to learn about training and exercise and everything, but you get to a certain point where you're like, you know a lot and you know what you can use, and figuring out how to use that more efficiently or use that better is what you need to prioritize. And being able to think differently or have a different perspective or drop another lens on your brain, I think is incredibly more important than just digesting another fitness book. I don't think it does as much for you. So I always keep a book like that in the hopper. So I'm reading Biocentrism, which is about how the universe is really generated by consciousness, and it's wild. It talks about quantum theory and all kinds of crazy stuff, and I'm digging it. I'm actually going to have a conversation with Kyle Langworthy from Mark Fisher Fitness about it soon. We were both reading it, but it's a wild book. I'd recommend anybody that's interested in kind of stretching their brain and maybe zoning out for a few minutes after you read it and being like, what the hell just happened to me? it's definitely one of those books. It's pretty awesome. And then Legacy. We're reading that as a staff, as great part of book. Our staff development right now. Yeah, absolutely. This is my third time through it. And every time, just like, there's still those moments where you get chills and you're like, you really understand why the All Blacks are who they are. And to like, to think like, how can we get on that level of performance? How can we perform at that high of a level day in and day out like they did? And, you know, we're using that to kind of build a little bit different structure into our staff, and we go through it every week. So I read ahead and I come up with our in-services based on that right now. So those are the two books I got, man.
Very cool. That great, great stuff. I'm going to have to check out the Biocentrism. I don't have that one. Centrism. Sorry.
Yeah.
I'm obviously Robert, not up on that level yet.
No, you are. Robert Lanz is the guy that wrote it. And it was funny. I posted about it on Facebook and Jeremy Frisch was like, I know that guy. He lives like right down the street from me. So it's pretty crazy.
That's awesome, man. All right. Number three. This is one I haven't asked anybody before, but I'm going to start asking more because I think cool. this can give us a lot of feedback onto somebody and where they're at. What's on your radar for continuing education in the future?
Well, the fitness thing, or I guess human body thing that has my interest is PRI. I want to take some PRI courses. I think that's as much from, you know, Chris went through the home study course for myokinematics. You know, we talked about it. He did some in-service stuff with us. And I think that's as much a philosophy course and a thinking course as it is an exercise course. So, or a rehab course, whatever you want to call it. So that really sparked my interest. And I'd really like to go down that way a little bit because there's so many people that I respect, including you and Bill, that are really into that stuff and use it really effectively. And I think it just makes so much sense. And I just want to know more about it. So I think that's really next on my radar. I feel pretty good about most of the other things that we do, you know, from an energy system standpoint or a strength or a mobility standpoint. I think in a lot of places we're good. I really want to understand that a lot better.
No, I think that's a great investment. And like you said, you've kind of got – this is something that I also try and explain to our interns is like, you need to learn how to be an effective coach first if you want to be in this world. You know what I mean? So learn how to teach the basic exercises. Learn how to interact with people. By all means, once you're getting up to speed on that, then start to throw in and understand PRI. But fantastic. And obviously, I'm heavily influenced by them because about everything on my blog these days has a tinge of PRI-ishness to it. So,
It just makes so much sense.
It does. It does. And I'm a huge fan. So number four, what's the next big thing for BSP Nova and Strength Faction?
Well, for Nova, it's a new facility. So we're expanding. Yeah, we're working on a few spots right now. Chris actually had a meeting today with a spot that looks pretty promising. So fingers crossed. So that's the next step for us there, grow into something bigger, be able to run some more programs that we want to run. And I think that's going to happen really soon for us. And it's that's a really cool and exciting process. It's also terrifying, as I'm sure, as I know that you know.
Yep.
But that's the big thing for us with BSP Nova next.
Awesome. Number five, and I didn't tell you I was going to ask this, but am I correct? Did you train with Mike Roussel for a while?
I did.
Tell me about that. He's savage. He is a savage for a nutrition dietitian guy. He's a monster.
A PhD doctor. Yeah, it was funny. Man, we got way too early. I think that's the first thing that we need to say because we trained at like 5 o'clock.
5 a.m., right?
Yeah, like 5 o'clock in the morning. And I don't know, I wasn't young. I was like 26, so I wasn't super young. But nonetheless, like I was a single guy and 26 and living in State College, Pennsylvania. So 5 a.m. is pretty brutal.
That's right.
But we did it. We did it all the time, and he trained so hard. Like I remember, I was doing I was doing a deadlift specific program at the time because I was going to compete in the spring. And he was doing some stuff that Joe Daldella put up for him. And there's a lot of energy systems development stuff. And he also wanted to deadlift 500. And so he had a lot of things going on. And it was just, he worked so hard, just brutal stuff the man would do to himself. And then the day he did deadlift 500 pounds, I swear to God, he knocked the wind out of me like right away. Like he started screaming. He came over and grabbed me and punched me in the guts. Like I couldn't breathe for like 5 minutes. But no, it was awesome, man. He was such a good training partner, such a good dude, so supportive. I think the first thing to say about Mike Roussel is how good of a human being he is. And because, you know, I got to know him and his family pretty well. And he's a guy that'll go out of his way to do just about anything for you. So it was a really cool experience to train with him and actually get close and be friends with him.
Yeah, that's awesome. He's actually shameless plug, but he's actually going to be one of our speakers at the Physical Prep Summit this year. So
that's fantastic. There you go.
He's awesome, man. All right, Todd. You've been awesome today, man. I appreciate you and your time. Where can my listeners find out more about you?
Great. Yeah. No, first, thank you, man. I appreciate you doing this. Like I said, this is an honor and to spend this time and get to chat with you. Like I said, I've looked up to you for a long time, so this is very cool for me. If people want to find out more about me, most of my stuff goes on strengthfaction.com now. So most of my writing goes there. And, you know, we're really trying to put out a lot of good stuff there. We have a free ebook that's out there now, too. So that's where most of my stuff goes. If you want to read and learn and that kind of stuff, I'm on all the social media channels as well. If you just search Todd Bumgardner, I'm sure you'll find me.
Perfect, man. I will make sure that I get all of that in the show notes so they can find you easily. But again, man, thanks so much for coming on, buddy. I really do appreciate it.
Thank you, Mike. I really appreciate it too, man.
All right. And to all my listeners, thanks for tuning in, and we will be back soon with our next episode. Take care. Preparation.